You are listening to smalldifferences.fireside.fm, your favorite cultural exchange program. I'm your host, K-Mel, and we have our first caller. Hello, how can I help you?
Hi, I seem to have previously been stuck in academia.
Ah, what's your name?
Chris. Hi.
And where are you from?
Oh, sorry, I'm breaking the fourth wall. Hi, Chris, Scotland, originally.
So, Chris, tell us about your problems with the academy.
Oh, come on, that's way too general.
Oh, Chris, tell me one specific problem with the academy.
Yeah, and this is why we're not on the radio. Oh, come on, really? I can't pick one. It's a knotty problem. Egotistical answer. The problem with the academy is I'm no longer in it, and I did care about some things. And there is one less person caring about those things there today because of that. I don't know, for someone who cares about the things that I care about, that seems kind of a shame.
I just can't stop talking like this. I like it way too much.
It's really weird and creepy. Please stop.
I'm afraid I may turn into Alex Jones or something.
Who?
Haven't you heard of Alex Jones?
I feel sure that I have, but I can't put a face.
The powder guy?
What?
The angry American radio podcast host who is mad about everything, especially the liberals.
Yeah, I try and steer away from that kind of thing because it makes me sad. Please,
I guess that's one for the show notes.
Please don't, which I will never watch. Yeah, please don't become that guy. It doesn't sound like, the trickle of listeners reduces to one really angry guy in Texas somewhere. Hi, Texas. I'm sure bits of you are very nice. Hi, Austin.
He is actually an angry guy in Texas, Austin, actually.
How can you be angry in Austin? It's like fearsomely liberal, or is that his problem? He's surrounded by liberals.
Yeah. And fluoride in the water.
Oh, is that what's doing it?
And chemtrails.
Obviously.
Yeah. So, our fifth and final episode in the Tale of the University and the Small Differences hosts.
I must say there's a degree of hubris in saying right at the start of this episode that we're going to limit it to five episodes. This is the fifth of three.
I know, but it can't go on.
It can't go. We can't carry on
much
like this. All right.
Next time we have to talk about happy things.
There are plenty of happy things. It's like the middle of the summer in Norway. It's pretty happy. All right.
We just had a rain record.
I read. How many days? 26 days or something, like with rain consecutively?
26?
Was it? It was something like that.
I thought it was more like 65.
Oh, I don't know. Sorry. There was a six.
You really don't know.
I really don't know. I wasn't there, man.
And you can't be sorry because you wasn't there.
Right. Well,
you in Oslo with the sun and the nice and the 17 degrees and yeah.
We might hit 22 today, not to rub it in, but has it really been very, very wet?
It actually was 26. It hasn't rained that much for so long since like 65 years ago or something.
There's your 65 number. Right, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, a day with rain in Bergen feels way longer. It feels like 2 days, actually.
At this time of year, you're basically like, it's 48 hours at that point. Mm. Wow. Having dispensed with the weather.
So this is an interesting episode because we have literally no show notes.
Yeah.
And you texted me earlier and said that you are in a zombie state.
Yeah, like, the curse of podcasting, right? Last week I was all geared up to talk about my exit from academia and everything, and then we kind of ran long on yours, which was great, and I regret nothing about that. And I spent a lot of time over the weekend thinking a bit more about what I had to say about it, and I've probably overthought it.
Podcaster's block.
I've gone numb from thinking about it.
Did you have any writer's block during your time in the academy?
No, I'm just letting the pause go for yucks. yeah, in that it was way easier to do research than write about it. I don't mind writing. I can write. But it was more interesting to be doing the research and finding the results, and it was more interesting to be teaching than writing up research. So in the sense that I could have published more, yeah.
You can always publish more.
You can always publish more. Yeah.
You could have always published more.
You could have always published more. What?
In retrospect.
Well, sure, yeah. Like, I guess you could have, like, skipped the kind of dinners and family occasions and, you know, speaking to your friends and stuff like that and just written more. We touched on this last time, right? Like, the idea that the kind of 40-hour work week is just a joke in academia. There's some research from maybe, I don't know, 10 years or so ago, maybe a little bit longer, showing that academics in the UK work on average, like, 55 hours a week. And I'd say, based on my own experiences, that's sometimes a conservative estimate. It's not a casual job.
And but also, it is not a jobby job.
Right, where I come from in Scotland, jobby means poo.
Yeah, exactly. So it can be a jobby job, or a job.
What? Malkovich, Malkovich? Malkovich, Malkovich, Malkovich. Let's just do the rest of the podcast like this.
I think we have to at least go past 100 before we begin with the concept episodes.
Okay. Jobby job. Unpack, please. And then clean your hands.
Because it's this weird... It is a job, but also kind of like a hobby.
Right, it's a vocation would be the English word, like if you found your vocation, right, that's kind of what you want to do with your life.
Yeah.
But it's a bit of a double-edged kind of a word, because people who do quote-unquote jobs that are their vocation usually don't get compensated for it enough. Classically, vocational jobs are like teachers and nurses, right? They do not get paid enough for the amount of shit that they have to deal with, literal and metaphorical. And academia is a bit like that. Like, if you want to do it, then that's sort of seen as enough. Actually, when I entered, I was thinking about this over the weekend. When I entered academia, pay was lagging way behind inflation and getting worse every year. And eventually, through union negotiation, the pay went up considerably, such that my salary in the space of about 4 years, basically doubled. So behind had it got. Like, I was starting from a relatively low bar, given the amount of kind of qualifications and education that I'd kind of gone through. But they overhauled the pay system a little bit, thanks to union negotiation. And it meant that my salary nearly doubled in a few years. But, like, that starting point was less than a lot of kind of recent graduates might have earned.
So, not to turn this into the privileged complaint podcast.
Oh, fuck no, well, I'm really privileged, yeah.
We are deep in it. But how did, sort of, just to get a sense of it, how, did the sort of the salary restrict you in any way in the beginning? Did you have... heavy quotation marks, sort of a struggle?
No, not in any kind of real sense. You know, like, yeah, full privilege declaration here. I was never at any point going, oh, crap, I can't make my rent. Oh, crap, I can't eat. It was never that bad. It was still perfectly livable on. So, no, it's not a kind of a cry of complaint about that. in the UK, and particularly the further south you go in the UK, there is a press on housing, and I managed to not get in that fix. But I know there are a lot of people who work in, like in London, for example, it's very expensive to live in central London. So you basically have to live outside, but then you spend a lot of time and money travelling into London if you work anywhere near there. And it's very difficult for people to kind of afford rent, never mind property, based on what they earn. So, yeah. No, I did not have it that badly, for the record.
So, what? Now I struggle to prod your sort of story, but you asked me last time if there were a point, sort of a moment where you sort of had to decide.
Nothing as knife edge as the place that you found yourself. Well, yes and no. You painted a very nice picture last time about that sort of that place where you found yourself deciding. Mine was way more complex in that it kind of, in time, like it unfolded over a period of much longer. So, quick timeline, got my lecturing job in 2002. Yeah, that sounds right. Handed in my thesis about 2 years later. Lecturing full time from then. Lecturing is like the word that we use to talk about the fact that you're kind of like you're doing a lot of teaching and you're doing some research on the side, but mostly teaching because that's the kind of job it was and that's the kind of university it was. It's probably worth pointing out that like you went to quite a kind of fancy old university, right, with kind of like fairly reasonable standing academically.
Sure.
Right. Like, my undergrad and postgrad degrees are from places that are quite historically kind of, they've been quite well thought of. And then I went to teach in a place that was, I think, not unfair to say, maybe a third tier university. Like, it wasn't old and grand and producing kind of world-changing research most of the time. It was not one of the kind of 1960s wave of universities either. It was a post-92 university, which means that it had only very recently become a university from being a college. I had an awesome record for teaching quality. And at the time when I was looking for a job, I actually really wanted to teach a lot. I never stopped wanting to teach a lot, actually. I really liked teaching. But it's almost the case that you can have one or two of those things, but you can't have both. If you go to university in the UK, the research quality is great, but the teaching is at best meh, or you get a few people who are great at it and everyone else is focused on research. And this was at the other end of the scale, where very, very few people were doing kind of field leading research, not none, but very, very few relatively. And everyone else was kind of, you know, doing all right or not producing very much research and quite focused on teaching quality, a lot of people. And that was a nice environment. It's great for the students. Open doors, first names, very friendly, which I really liked. Very flat.
I guess this is the debate, the balance between teaching and researching.
Yeah.
Do you have that in?
Yeah. one of my big gripes, and we can just like hop over a whole load of stuff right here and just cut straight to that point, is that there's no, in most universities, there's no career track if you want to excel in teaching or if you want to primarily teach. And I didn't necessarily want to primarily teach, I wanted to do both. But every hour you spend on improving teaching quality, or actually teaching is an hour you're not researching, is an hour you're not devoting to research and publication, and in other words, furthering your career. And there are a few universities in the UK who I think have created like teaching track positions, but at that point you're basically saying, okay, I'm not going to have a research career. And that dichotomy sucks. And the fact that even any kind of career teaching track is like a minority idea sucks. And so what you're left with is, if you like teaching and if you enjoy improving teaching quality and trying to do better at that and trying to make a good experience for students, your career is for shit. You will never publish enough.
Yeah. So I don't think I buy the distinction really, or the dilemma. I buy it in the sense of that's how we have structured our universities and made them to be like ETCS machines.
Who now?
Student credits. Well, study credits,
Oh,
right?
right.
The student turn, right? So, but I wonder if there's always profiles, but I wonder if a good university, to sort of obtain good university teaching, you have to have one foot in the research part and one foot in the teaching part.
I completely agree.
And I'm suspect if you can really be a great researcher if you can't teach the stuff.
I sus
But I'm fretting on have thin ice or something, but
I think it's possible to do great research without being able to teach well about it, because I've seen that a million times. I've seen people who cannot communicate their research. Some of them can, some of them are amazing at it, enthusiastic and good at communication. Other people are just good at doing research, and that's fine. But the problem is that the system only incentivizes research behavior, it does not incentivize teaching quality.
perhaps I have a humanities bias here, because so much of the humanities research is exactly to try to express complex ideas, not simply
Simplistically?
not in but yeah, you have to have sort of clear thinking about it, and that would imply that you also can communicate the
No,
stuff.
absolutely not. I think these are
Not?
two, like, not to go all Garner's multiple intelligences or anything, but like, I've met people who are extremely good researchers and very good teachers, but who could not, like, they're very shrewd in pursuing a research track, for example, could not write about it, could teach it. Could not communicate it lucidly at all. Like their direction of thought and travel was bang on, but like they struggled to kind of actually line up the argument ducks in a row. And I've met people who were doing great research who were appalling at teaching it, because they could not communicate it. And they could write a great research paper, but they couldn't communicate it at a level that was accessible. And I've read,
What do you mean by
like
communicating? Sort of
in
talk about
person, like
it?
actually. Sit someone down and go, right, here's let me tell you about this thing, and in a way that you can make sense of it, that makes sense to you. And I think that writing about your research and talking about it to people who don't know about it are completely separate skills, and you often get one but not the other. But to come back to your other point, I feel like it would be artificial. I felt all the time that I was not doing enough research. Like, I ended up being a course leader on the neuropsychology degree. And I was painfully aware of how little I had, how little kind of practical experience I had in that beyond my PhD. And I was like, you need to be doing the research and you need to be teaching the stuff that you're researching. And there's like a synergy between those two things. And it's very artificial to say, okay, now you're going to teach and you're going to research and never the two shall meet. But that seems to be the direction some of this is going, which I found a bit painful, really. But the most painful thing of all was that research is incentivized. Research behavior is incentivized, and everything that foregrounds research behavior is sort of rewarded, and everything that foregrounds teaching quality is actively punished, because there's often no reward mechanism for people who care about teaching quality, other than students coming and saying, thanks, I really enjoyed the lecture, or thanks, I really get this, which no one ever sees or knows about, apart from you.
And not to turn this into how great is Norway again, that we have begun to see some efforts to promote teaching as a thing of the university here in Bergen, at least. So they have just started giving what they call excellent lecturers a pay raise, actually, like 50,000 Norwegian kroner. I'm not sure about the operationalization of that thing. I think it's putting the stuff in the wrong place. But
say more.
It would be better if they actually gave all the PhD students that do most of the teaching some training, for example.
There's no training?
No.
That's interesting. You see, I had to go and get like a teaching certificate from the university when I started. They wanted everyone to have like either X years experience or to go and get one of these.
On the paper, you have access to such a course, but that is constantly filled up by the regular staff.
Oh.
So in practice, you haven't. And also, I guess you could, I guess you could enroll in some kind of teaching seminar or something on yourself, but it isn't
Yeah, with all that free time.
Yeah. So no, you are just thrown out to the wolves.
Yeah, sink or swim. Mixed wolf metaphor there. Yeah. Swimming with the wolves. So, yeah. Swims with wolves. Okay, there's your problematic North American native name. Yeah.
So, yeah.
So the system does not incentivize good teaching if you want to be visibly and financially rewarded. Do research. Stuff the rest.
But do you think the prospect that you found yourself in about being a quotation mark career lecturer without a research track, was that sort of the spark to your uncertainty? Or,
well, the thing is, we were all researchers. Like, I was still producing some research. Yeah. So it wasn't like there was no track to choose. But it was just every hour that I spent trying to make a better teaching experience was kind of a small career suicide. And I got to the point where I was like actually doing research, and I was researching my own teaching. Like, I was researching kind of optimal ways of teaching and of sharing information in such a way that it would be remembered by students. And like, that became my kind of research passion. So I did have a research career. It was just kind of researching teaching as opposed to researching like the brain or whatever. And it just, I think that was not what broke me, because I was really enthused about it, and like to the point where I was kind of doing all the teaching and trying to do the research around the teaching and teaching Taekwondo two nights a week in a city that was like, you know, well, either at home, which is like an hour away from work, or like another hour and a half away from that again. And somehow managing to juggle all that for a bit. And that kind of worked quite well for a while. But the thing that broke me was actually like just all the unnecessary shit that was attached to the job. I was thinking about this a bit over the weekend. Like, you're having a meeting, it's early August and the academic year is going to kick off again. And you find out from your head of department that now we've just franchised this degree in Greece. So you are going to have more marking this year because you have to second mark all of the stuff from this college degree that we're now franchising, in addition to all the exam marking that you do. And when I talk about exam marking, there was a year when I had a pile of exam manuscripts that was pushing 50 centimetres high because the year group was 250 students and they all answered my exam questions on several different modules. And I had to mark all those. And then you're like, oh, well, everyone's going to have, we have a slightly bigger year group this year, so everyone's going to have 15 final year projects to mark instead of average 10. And we don't really have any more time for that, so if you could just take like 90 minutes instead of 2 hours. You know, like it would be better if it had been communicated like that, but it was just like, here's more stuff. Oh, and we've just started teaching this degree at a local college, so you have to travel 90 minutes. You have to travel 90 minutes to this college and back another 90 minutes. So all the first year teaching that you do now has to be delivered there as well. So you just have to do those sessions again. you know, again, with often like relatively little notice and no kind of acknowledgement that this is just adding to the pile. Sorry, that was a bit of a rant.
No, it wasn't. It was a perfectly apt rant, if it was. But there's a lack of there's certainly a lack of acknowledgement, it seems, for the kind of the work you did. And perhaps empathy or understanding, at least.
Yeah, it became increasingly apparent to me that the management of the university did not give a fuck. And this kind of, you asked me if there was like a point. The point came when, so our previous head of department was promoted to dean. He was a good guy, and he held the department well together through like strike action and stuff like that. He was a very good politician, actually, a very good administrator, if you like. And he was promoted, and initially we had for about a year a really good dynamic young person who came and ran the department. He was very switched on. Under her, we would not have debated photocopying for 50 minutes per last episode. And she's just ran a very tight ship, very nice, very diplomatic. But she didn't want to do that job for a long time. She had other things to do. She had a very thriving research career. So we got a head of department who was like the worst but default internal choice, who could not manage. She micromanaged. She was a bully. She was not really amazing at anything. And it just started to, like, the whole department just kind of started to fragment under this. Like, she could not keep the department psychopath in check. You know, like, previously, his bad behaviour had been kind of punished or at least warned by the previous heads of department, and he could not, like, we're not talking serial killing, we're just talking kind of reprehensible behaviour that should not happen and should be treated properly. And she just had either no interest or no awareness or just no ability to kind of check his behaviour. So I ended up with colleagues who were being kind of manipulated slash exploited by this guy. What else? She bullied people. She would call...
Wait a minute.
What?
You just said a lot of things.
Yeah. I'm not going to name names.
I'm not going to ask you to, but I'm interested in because it is interesting to unpack because I'm not comparing it to other workplaces, but it seems that there are ample opportunity for sort of misuse of power and weird stuff in academy when it comes to, for example, psychopaths.
Yeah, there's a conversation about, like, that academia rewards psychopathic behaviour, in that if you just want to manipulate other people and get ahead, then academia is perfectly structured for you. And take all the credit where you can.
But could you give an example of such behaviour? If you should sort of list warning signs, here's what to look for.
Taking credit for...
Is there a psychopath in your workplace?
Taking credit for other people's work, not doing work and making other people who did not have that as one of their tasks have to do that work, and then taking credit for it anyway. Saying one thing to those people and then doing something else or saying something else. Just manipulation, really. And this never happened to me because I wasn't in that subject area, but it was happening to my colleagues, and I felt really bad for them. And I felt really bad that this was, like, apparently sufficiently acceptable that no one would do anything about it, and perhaps I should have stood up for them more.
Then again, you don't want to... You probably don't want to run into that person's sort of spotlight or something?
I think they knew that I wouldn't take any shit, and that's why I never got any shit.
Yeah.
But that is almost victim blaming. Like, that's almost the flip side of victim blaming, to say that my colleagues in some way deserve this, which they did not. I didn't have to work with him.
I have a good friend who also is in psychology.
Sorry to hear that.
Research. no, he's doing great actually, but that's just because he's a sane guy. But he told me that you generally find all the psychopathic ailments within the faculty of psychology, including the psychopaths and so on.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that not everybody, but a chunk of people who end up in psychology, like everyone on some level wants to understand themselves, right? That's a completely understandable kind of thing. But there are some people who find themselves in psychology in part because they're looking for some explanation. But it depends on, like, you know, that's a gross oversimplification. And a lot of people who are just fascinated by the human experience, which is what a lot of psychology is about. I was into the meat end of psychology. I was like, right, what's this bit of the brain do? You know, that's about as far away from kind of supernatural experience or counseling or other things as you can possibly get in psychology. What does your friend do?
He actually researched the kind of diagnosis of psychopathy.
So he compared
the two sort of diagnostic, or it isn't actually diagnostic because it isn't in the DSM, I think. But it is sort of a research category.
Is your friend actually a psychiatrist or a psychologist?
Is actually...
Does he have a medical degree?
No, he hasn't.
Okay, so psychologist then.
He's a psychologist.
Clinical psychologist, I guess.
He's married with a... psychiatrist?
Psychiatrist?
Psychiatrist.
Yeah.
I often find that if the Norwegian and English word are quite alike, it is...
It's
more difficult
it's way
to
harder,
say.
Isn't it? Yeah, I get that.
That's why many Norwegians say anal is this.
Well, in psychology, you kind of, yeah, anyway, you've got both in a way, like Freud and statistics.
Yeah. But he researched the research on psychopathy. Psychopathy.
That's a hard word in English. Don't sweat it.
That's an interesting topic of itself because of the background of these tests and the controversy about them.
I feel like we should probably name check John Ronson's The Psychopath Test at this point. Which, full disclosure, I haven't read all of.
Because this whole thing about the original test, they tried to license it or something.
I don't know.
So you have to ask for permission it's some weird
there's
stuff.
There's a million proprietary tests in psychology.
Yeah. I guess the student to the original guy made their own thing, and there's controversy between those and so on and so on. But what he found is that when he did research in a prison, actually, and he found that people who scored high on this test, they also showed a high degree of empathy or empathetic understanding, at
least. How does that work? Or is that what people use to manipulate other people?
Exactly.
Hmm.
So I think you actually have some sort of bathtub distribution here. So if you are a quotation mark normal, you have a certain degree of empathy. And if you score higher on this test, it sort of decreases and then it increases again.
Interesting.
It's the Dexter thing, I guess.
I guess. That's a good show. Yeah. Well, I've only seen the first four seasons, but they were good.
I only saw the first.
So you can stop there. That's cool.
Yeah.
We've diverged. Somewhat. Yeah. Something institutional psychopathy.
Yeah. But we haven't really dived into your last months of the Academy. Well, how did it all go down? Were bridges burned?
I want to say in flames. No. So the department started to fragment, right? Under this person who was not really fit to be in charge, and it became apparent that senior management did not give a fuck. Like, as long as things were basically ticking over and, like, the requisite paperwork was being returned on time and blah, 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 you know, whatever. Students weren't complaining, you know, so it was fine. Everything's fine. But it was not fine, actually. The department became a more fragmented place. We didn't pull together as much. It started to kind of, like, with kind of people's... I don't know. It just started to become a less pleasant place. And like when I started, right, people would go for lunch together. They would go and get coffee together and just hang out a little bit, just chat. And there was no time for that anymore. Everyone was just more pressed. There was just more to do. And so all the social glue kind of, it was lacking, right? Because people just had too much to do to kind of go and bond with each other and go and hang out with each other. And so we began to splinter a little bit as a department and grow as well, because the student body had grown a lot, so we had to kind of take on more staff. And so it became a kind of a less collegiate place to be. And I like a collegiate atmosphere. Like, I get out of bed in the morning because I want to work with colleagues and do stuff. And research is lonely. Also, like we talked about this last week, you can spend a lot of time on your own researching, writing, thinking, iterating on ideas. And that was kind of lonely. And I was reading a lot of the kind of the tech press stuff. So I had started talking to people outside the academy a lot about what was happening out there and about the ideas that I had about sort of attention and how you improve visual presentation of information. And I got asked to speak at some industry conferences by people I knew, and I got asked back to speak at more stuff, and that kind of snowballed and became a thing. And I was like, this is really interesting. There's actually like a use for my stuff out there. People are interested in the academic side because they can see that it has lessons for them. So I went and I talked about attention and memory and stuff like this to people who were in the business of communicating, like technical communicators, for example. People who work in sort of software and related industries where it's incredibly important to manage people's attention and to communicate clearly. And that was kind of, and so I was doing a lot of, not a lot of that stuff, but doing a bit of that stuff and reading a lot of the kind of the same stuff that you were reading at the time, you know, on the internet about, like, I know, everything from Inbox Zero to agile software development stuff, and just thinking, feedback loop is too slow where I am. I can't see positive change, and it's very, very difficult to make positive changes because you take, like, if you want to iterate on a lecture, it's next year that you get a chance to do that, except in the stats teaching I did, which was repeated like four times in the semester because the class was enormous and we had to break it across several classes. But yeah, so, you know, I did stuff. I taught myself how to make like instructional videos and screencasts and stuff like that. And, you know, I was just trying to be more inventive about stuff. And it wasn't really being rewarded. I got nominated for a National Teaching Fellowship, which is really nice. But they wanted to see more. They said I was like too early in my career, which is fair enough. They wanted to see more stuff. The year I left, I got like the university's award for a personal tutor of the year, which is basically like the kind of pastoral care that you do for students. And that was voted for by my students. And I was really grateful for that. It was really nice. It's too late. I was on my way out, but it was nice. The recognition, which came from students, not the academy. Which is completely typical. Try to think what else happened. I just got really depressed. I, for a while, was genuinely depressed, but like functionally depressed in the sense of I could still go to work. Like I'm not getting out of bed depressed. And this wasn't quite that. This was just trudging. I self-medicated a lot with Sigur Rós. So
that helped?
In a way, like I remember just doing a lot of kind of... So I had like an hour commute on the train. And I remember just being on the train a lot. Just kind of tucked into a ball, listening to Sigur Rós going back and forward. It was kind of comforting. And then, like, I kind of came out of that. Like, that was just a kind of slightly paralyzed place, because at this point, right, I couldn't have got my job back. So I was basically stuck. Because I didn't have any, like, you know, I've been in the academy with, like, a couple of years hiatus working since, well, I've been in, like, full-time education at that point for, like, a huge chunk of my life, and then, like, doing a research and kind of teaching job. Like, I don't have any validation of being able to work out there. And, in fact, most of my work experience outside the academy at that point had been a very unpleasant year working for a really horrible boss. So it's like, what am I good for? I don't know what I can do. There's all this interesting stuff happening out there, but I don't feel like I'm qualified to do any of it. So it was a really helpless feeling. We talked about learned helplessness last week. And it's a bit like that. It's like, nothing else I'm qualified for. So I just spent a while feeling very helpless. I cannot remember why, but I enrolled myself to run a half marathon. And I told everybody and made them sponsor me. But I asked to be sponsored for charity. That's like 20, 21 kilometres or something. It's quite a long run. So I had to train for it. Because, you know, when you've publicly declared for a thing, you know that you're going to do a thing, you have to do it. You have to follow it up, which is the point of telling people and getting them to sponsor me. And I spent a lot of time just training and just running. And just, like, not being very happy in my head necessarily, but just doing that. And that maybe helped me over the hump or whatever. And then I started getting really angry with the situation, you know, with the fact that no one gave a fuck and I could do more or less what I wanted. And as long as I handed in reports on time and students weren't complaining, I could be teaching absolute shit. I could, you know, the whole thing could be going to hell in a handbasket and nobody cared. My colleagues cared. We cared about each other. But the complete lack of giving a shit by kind of management. And it was just really unpleasant. And we had this manager who's really awful. We kind of culminated in having this session, which was like an all-day session where she gave up. She just, like, I don't know why we were having that session, but we had this session in the summer. And it was maybe like 1 p.m. and we had until 3 or something like that. And she was just like, she just didn't care anymore. And we were like, well, if you don't care, like, why should we care? You know, why are we all here? Why are we wasting this time? You clearly don't give a shit about any of this. And at some point around then, I just went, right, this is going to be my last year in academia. I've no idea what I'm going to do, but I'm done. I talked about it with my husband and didn't tell anyone else. But it was just like, right, this is going to be my last year in academia. And that was a really good decision. Because I spent the entire last year having a really good time. Because instead of going, oh my God, yeah, another year of bullshit and all of this stuff, and like lots of rewarding things happening, like lots of lovely, rewarding teaching experiences and interesting stuff and nice colleagues, everything like that. But just so much crap, and just every year, just more crap and more shit and more stuff you have to do and not enough time. But the last year was great. Because everything, it was a little bit sad. Because everything was like, oh, this is the last time I'm going to do this. Oh, this is the last time I'm going to do that. But at the same time, I was like, oh, this is the last time I'm going to do this. I should really value it. And it was amazingly enriching, in a way.
But with that kind of sort of new mindset, couldn't you just continue?
No, I think it was like, I can only do this because I know it's the last time. I don't, like, if I'd been really smart, I might have gone, right, I'm going to do this, and every year I'm going to review whether this is my last year. I'm going to treat every year as my last year. But fundamentally, I think I'd kind of blown a fuse at that point. I was just like, all right, I'm done, I need to get out of here, this is unhealthy. like, so many of my colleagues at any one time, so many of my colleagues were off with, like, stress-related illness. You know, like, depressed or anxious or, like, physical complaints that had come from being depressed and anxious. I was just like, this can't be me.
Yeah, I guess, thinking about it, those who thrive in the academy seems also to be those who... they don't care so much about management and all the politics and stuff. That seems more focused on their research and teaching.
Or just research.
And act kind of indifferent to all the other stuff, it seems. And that for a idealistic student or something, that is kind of frustrating because you try to point out, don't you see the system is broken? We have to fix it. And they are, it's always been broken.
Yeah. I had a very lovely colleague who treated it very much like a kind of 9-to-5 job. And he just did as much as he could in that time and tried not to worry about it otherwise. And was just like, yeah, it's broken. I just do what I can. I'm here to earn money and I'll do the best things I can do at that time. And he was a lovely, lovely guy. And not everyone wants to engage with academia at the kind of this is my life level. And that's okay. It's not for me and it's not for you, but okay. But yeah, the last year was really good. Because I knew in my head, I was like, you know, I have this secret. I'm going. I have no idea how I'm going to get out, but I'm done after this year.
But at some point, you had to have an idea of what you were going
to
do.
Yeah. So like in January, February, I started looking around. I was like, right, let me see if I can find a job that I could do. Like, you know, not at this point unaware of the fact that I have some skills and some knowledge that are kind of somewhere will be of use. It's just how to translate that into an outside job. And a friend of mine, Roger, said, I've heard Skype are really nice to work for. You should maybe look there and see if they've got anything. I looked at their website. And one of the things that I found was an internship for the summer. And it didn't look like it was paid or anything, but it was an internship. And I thought, well, maybe I'll give this a punt. So I sent in my application and I went to London for an interview. And they basically kind of offered it me right there in a way. They were like, we were expecting someone really junior, but you have all this kind of research, like human factors type research experience. And you know some statistics and like you're way more than we were looking for. But would you be interested? And by the way, we think we found some money. Like it'd be like a 40% pay cut, but I didn't think I was going to get any money. So I was really happy with that. Obviously you have to come and be in London for 3 months. I didn't live in London at the time. I was like, yeah, all right, cool. Let's do that. And so I announced that I was going to leave my job. And the guy who'd been the head of department and was now the dean said, like, are you sure you want to do this? Like, we'd maybe be making some voluntary redundancies in a couple of months. And I could have hung around and tried to wait for that money. And if I'd been really smart, I would have said, can I just take a 3-month sabbatical over the summer and then we'll talk about that redundancy money? But I didn't think of that at the time. I was just like, no, I need to get out. So I said, yeah, I'm sure. And I told my colleagues with very mixed feelings because it was good news for me, but I was so sorry to leave them there. You know, I felt like I was kind of abandoning ship and leaving people there. Because we had all been in it together, like, you know, there were kind of groups of us who were sort of quite close, and it was a shame to say that. But at the same time, I felt like I was doing it for my own kind of personal mental health. It seemed important to do. So I went. I was an intern for 3 months.
Survivor's guilt.
Oh, total survivor guilt. It hasn't really gone away. To the point where, like, in the months and years that followed my leaving, I took a lot of calls and emails from people who were trying to get out. And either I knew in person or I knew someone they knew. and the person say, oh, like, Chris got out, go and talk to her. So I've, like, I've had this kind of drip. It's sort of dried up now, but for a long time I had this kind of drip of people going, hi, I just want to chat to you about, like, how do I sell myself out of academia? You know, what do I do? So it sort of created this, like, small underground railroad of people who were trying to make themselves relevant in kind of non-academic jobs.
Yeah, you smuggled people out of the ivory tower.
I did. I did.
Of the basement of the
under my
tower.
Coat.
It's so weird. We have sort of the... It is a mount of science and the highest institution for knowledge and so on. It is this grand place, and we're talking about it as a sort of this cult that you have to sort of draw people out of.
Right.
Some people.
Right. It's both things. It's this amazing, shiny machine that goes fast and does extraordinary things, but then underneath there are these people who are, like, being worked to death like slaves in the mines, you know, without seeing very much daylight. Yeah.
So you were an intern.
Yeah. Oh, it was great.
Yeah. This podcast are sponsored by Skype, powering communication everywhere. Yeah, okay.
Blah, blah, yeah.
Couldn't Skype sponsor? It's weird. The world's podcast production is actually powered by Skype.
I think that's probably true.
And they don't. I haven't heard they sponsor anything. It's Microsoft.
Yeah, I was going to say they've got Sugar Daddy now. They don't need anyone.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was very liberating, not knowing anything again. A bit scary. But very cool to just go to a job and go, right, I know nothing. I'm junior. It's very nice not to have very much responsibility. Like, contrast this kind of thing of going from, like, a very long hours job where I'm responsible for a lot of students. You know, I've got, like, three cohorts of students who are my personal kind of students that I look after. I've got, like, lots of courses that I teach on, lots of modules and stuff like that. I'm a course leader, I'm senior lecturer, I've got all this stuff going on. I'm like a national teaching body for psychology, you know, like, I'm on all this stuff. And then I go to this job where I'm just, like, for 40 hours a week, I get the gist of what's going on, but I don't really know anything. I've never done agile software development before. No one expects very much of me. You know, like, my task in one day is, like, maybe make a PowerPoint sort of deck summarizing our results so that they can be played back to product owners.
Oh, I'm so
sorry.
Yeah,
well, I think it was Keynote, to be fair, but yeah, still. You know, like, okay, come and help me set up the lab. Okay, you know, like, simple, really simple things, like, just this blistering lack of complexity and, like, not having to juggle, like, actually my boss at Skype had to juggle a million things, but they were all kind of related things. He was doing the job of about three people.
Did I know that you were this doctor, this previous sort of leader in a sense?
Nah. I mean, I was older than your average kind of person who was going to come in and do that job. Like, sometimes I would go, okay, right, I just figured out why this didn't work in testing today. Like, it was a user research position primarily. And I'd look at it and go, right, okay, I can see what's happening here. So this is change blindness that's happening. And let me show you a video on YouTube that explains why we got the results today that we did. How can we design around that problem? And it was really nice to be able to come with that stuff sometimes. Like, it wasn't every day. It was maybe, like, every couple of weeks or something. I would go, ah, okay, there's a psychology related explanation for why we saw what we saw today. And people appreciated that. They didn't necessarily know that I'd come from a background of doing the stuff that I did. But I didn't make a big deal of it either because I was in an environment where I knew very little. And it was nice just to be kind of low profile. But at the same time, there was obviously relevance for the stuff that I'd done before. So it was pretty cool. It was a nice summer. I stayed with friends, like, you know, I didn't really have a lot of money to be doing this with, so I just stayed in a friend's spare room. I'm incredibly grateful to them for that. But can you imagine, like, if I'd had kids at this point, can you imagine this whole, like, how this thing would have played out? Like, doing this incredibly high-pressure job, trying to manage kids. Like, you don't get to move away from home for 3 months and do an internship if you're trying to bring up kids. You know, well, not as a woman anyway, not usually. There's a bit more equality here.
So, but don't have kids, and if you have them, put them away. That's immoral, right? Especially if you
no, that's
have
immoral.
Okay. Yeah, but that's actually an important point. Yeah.
Yeah. And
yeah.
But they were really clear. There won't be work for you at the end of this. This is not like the kind of internship that leads to a job. We just have money for 3 months. So, and that was cool. I found another job via a friend Zoe. I went to chat to people at Mendeley, plug. And I was like, so I've just done three months at Skype doing user research. Is that of interest to you? And they were like, yeah, come and work for us for 2 months. So I worked in a very small, very agile team, doing basically managing user research continuously for a few teams for 2 months. And at the end of that, I got like a proper digital agency job. And that kind of felt like, okay, right, I can do this now. I have validity of some kind.
At any point, did you regret? Did you miss the university?
I miss my colleagues. I missed my students. I still do, both. I really like nerding out, but I've been lucky to be involved in some really heavyweight software development projects where it was a bit like doing a thesis or something or doing kind of research, because you just show up every day with the same people, work on the same project for like 18 months or 2 years. And that's quite intensive, and you get that depth that you get in academia of kind of really immersing yourself in a thing. And not all the work that I do is like that. Like a lot of the work we do is slightly more piecework than that, slightly, you know, like less immersive. But there's enough nerding. The rest of it, nope.
Could you imagine yourself going back at some point?
I cannot imagine the kind of change necessary. Like, I like teaching. I have no aversion to doing research. I think one of the things I was desperately in search of was shorter feedback loops and shorter iterations. And I think I would really struggle with that. Like, I tried to exert a lot of change while I was there, and my colleagues and the institution generally were not receptive to that. How can we make this go faster? How can we make change happen faster? How can we improve this? And academia just doesn't really work like that. And I think I would find that unbearably frustrating now. It was quite frustrating then. How about you?
Because I think perhaps there are different environments at different universities. And for example, in Bergen, you have these new clusters where they place the sort of kind of research communities closer to other communities. So this is perhaps a bit cliche of the age, but they're closer to sort of a startup hub and so on. So it is implied that they perhaps evolve and develop into working more like we do in the kind of digital bureau stuff.
More emphasis on kind of innovation and iteration of stuff and going faster.
Yeah, and teamwork at least. And so on. So in that kind of environment, I could see myself doing more of an academic thing. And I also could see myself returning to a teaching position at a later stage.
Yeah, I wouldn't rule out the teaching thing. Like, I have some teaching coming up here, which is cool. But in a very semi-academic context.
But yeah. And I have this occasional I'm sort of hired to, as a guest lecturer and so,
right.
and so on occasions, so I get my fix, you can say.
Right. Is it nice to just be able to kind of waltz in, give the lecture and waltz out again and not deal with any of the kind of accompanying shit?
It's very nice.
Do you feel a little bit bad for the people who are there all the time and who do not have this privilege of coming in, giving a nice lecture, and then leaving again?
I don't think... I'm not sure, because... I'm not sure, because I have thought about it. Would I recommend people to get a PhD or to get into that stuff? And I haven't really decided. Because I get it. I get for those people who are in for it because they love the research or the subject or whatever. I get that. But at the same time, they put themselves at some kind of risk. And they will... It is... Well, they will experience hard stuff that they probably don't need to experience. But,
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Like, there's a lot to recommend it. There's a lot of freedom. It's very stimulating and exciting. You just have to be robust or indifferent to the kind of crap that comes with it, right?
Yeah, and we paint this kind of black picture of the whole thing, and it is perhaps important to stress that not everyone has it like this. There are people who are in the university who are happy and have a good experience and have a great work environment.
Yeah, they're probably teaching about 2 hours a week and the rest is research, and they probably have lots of kind of postgrad students to help them with the research and the kind of the drudgery.
Yeah, but not that's perhaps the cliche, but
it's not untrue. The people that I met who were doing best in their careers are generally people who have managed to negotiate very few teaching hours, leaving more time for them to do research.
Is this is it the end?
I don't know. Maybe. Have I said anything that is? I don't know. Like, I feel like our experiences were like very similar. So I'm trying to look for something that is kind of noticeably different from one country to the other. Like, to come back to the childcare thing, there's a lot more equality of parenting here. Like, you can split parental leave. Like, if people have children, it seems to be really common that my colleagues with children will take, like, I'm taking 3 months off or 4 months off on the mama perm or papa perm. And, like, I'm doing it because my wife did it last time. Like, we've had another kid, or we're having another kid, and it's my turn. And that's much more seldom in the UK. Like, in the UK, I think statutory paternity leave for fathers is like 2 weeks, and that's it, and then you're back. And I think there's some effort to change the law. It might just have changed, I'm not sure, but like, the long shadow is basically mothers go back to work after months/years, or sometimes not at all. Fathers go back to work immediately. And so right there's like a huge lack of equality. I had one colleague who had her children early and then did her PhD. And it was kind of strategic that she did it that way around. And I'm boggled in a way that people have to make these choices.
I guess I'm the wrong person to ask about paternal care. Because...
yeah, but you have a bunch of very Norwegian attitudes. You don't necessarily have to be a parent to comment.
I guess not. But well, I like the fact that it's more equal. And I also guess I have the expectation that it should be.
Well, yeah. Hi, it's 2017.
And I like the fact that it is possible to get close to that. No surprise there. So, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like the UK is kind of retrograde in this way. There was a great news story this week about a school where it was really hot and in the UK. I don't know if you read about this. And the teacher said, I don't care how warm it is, you all have to come to school wearing a school uniform. And there was some discussion about the fact that girls get to wear a skirt in hot weather, which is, I presume, cooler than wearing trousers, I would say. And the boys came to school wearing skirts as a protest. And I'm just so in awe that they all did this. I think it's incredibly cool. Their parents seemed incredibly cool with it. And it kind of... The flip side of that was a piece that I read in Aftenposten, where they have a kind of regular column written by quote-unquote young people. I hate that phrase. It's so othering. It's so, like, by definition, it's... I'm not a young person if I say young people. Saying boys are really... Like, there's just been this big deal about how boys are being outstripped academically by girls, and except in physical education or something like that. And... it was written by a young guy, and he was saying, like, it's fine, it's great that feminism has taken off. I would describe myself as a feminist, but there's a whole half of the conversation that's not being had here, which is that the list of acceptable behaviours for boys is incredibly restrictive. Like, we've seen all this expansion for girls, like coding for girls and stuff like that. But if you're a boy, you're really constrained. And I found that interesting in this country of relative equality. I don't disagree. I'm sure it's happening. I'm just, it's an interesting debate.
Yeah, I think, I think we tapped into that, when I talked with Marina Warner, actually, because she has written a lot of stuff on gender and sort of the role that the culture allows for different gender types to take.
Right.
And she has, of course, mostly had written this in the 90s, being focused on the role of the women. But she also mentioned that boys and men have kind of a restricted sort of type, sort of a spot to fill.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah. The metaphor is, you know, like, I get to come to work every day wearing trousers if I want. You can come to work wearing a skirt, but your the reception that you got would be, I think, different. Sorry that we went down a gender equality thing. I don't know. Just seemed apposite. It's a thing that comes up a lot in academia. Oh, God, and I didn't even talk about, by the way, like, my husband was in an academic job at the same time, and the only reason that he could continue, that I could go and take this internship, was that he had 2 more years on his yet another temporary contract in that academic job. That's a whole other rant. But one of the reasons that I felt really trapped was that if you're in an academic job and your partner is in an academic job, you basically have to move city, usually, if you want another one. Excuse me. And this might not be apparent to people who haven't really worked in the academy, that, like, if you're a specialist in the kind of research that you do, another job that suits you in a department that suits you, where people are doing the kind of work that you do, might be hundreds or even thousands of miles away. And if you want to go and do that job, your partner has to find something that also suits their specialism within commuting distance of that. And like, this is something of a problem in the UK for academics. It's mind-blowingly problematic in the US, where research institutions are often hundreds and hundreds of miles away, sometimes thousands of miles away from each other. And you get people in these weird lives as academics where they're married to each other, but they're like living 1,000 miles apart because they want to do what they love.
Conclusion, if you want to thrive in the academy, be single, don't get kids.
Right. Be a psychopath. And that helps.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, okay, right. We should really stop talking about this now. I'm so done.
Let's dive into follow-up.
We should do that.
Without fanfare. Well, with fanfare. More colleagues have started to listen to our thing.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And one of the Martas, we have more of them.
What's the plural? Martar?
At least two. Marti.
Martarna?
Mm. She mentioned, she listened to our episode where we discussed doors.
Yeah. And then she visited your office.
but she had the insight that doors tend to go inwards because, no, outwards because of the safety.
Mm. Like fire.
Because if you find yourself stuck in a room and your paper burst in fire because of the unfairness in the academy, you have to get yourself out of there. And then she came to Bergen, and there, our doors tend to go inwards. No escape. For example, in my podcast studio here, my door goes inwards. So if Skype burst into fire, that's the end of me.
I'm good to go. This door opens out. Sorry. Nice knowing you and all. Thanks for the podcast.
Did we actually link to the 99% invisible?
I believe we did. We can do it again, though.
Yeah. The troll's dick.
This is a sorry tale.
It wasn't when last week. So last week, it was a happy tale.
Yeah, you were going to talk about it last week, and we didn't have time.
Yeah. What is the troll's dick?
You tell me.
What is it actually?
It's a rock formation.
It's a rock formation. Yeah. And how did it get its name?
I wonder. it's fair to say, it's actually called Trollpicken, right? Troll dick.
Yeah.
It stands proud of the rest of the rock, shall we say.
Yeah, so it is a phallic rock formation. And it got some attraction as this sightseeing spot. And you can actually climb up on it and get your picture taken. And at some point during this week, some trolls decided to ruin it for everybody. And they actually cut it down.
It's incredibly sad. I was really bummed when you sent me that link. Like, why?
Yeah, indeed. There's no explanation for it. The troll dick, I guess.
Yeah. The only saving grace, at least as far as the national news industry is concerned, is that there are any number of opportunities to pun on what has happened. They're exactly the same as you would get, I guess, in the UK, right? The troll dick will rise again. and variations thereon.
Yeah, because you said it. Because there is actually hope for the troll dick.
Not a phrase I ever thought we would be saying on this podcast, but hey, every day's an
thanks
adventure.
Thanks to the Norwegian Dugnadsson, people have mustered and gathered their small amount of whatever money they could find under the couches. And at this time, they have collected 195,720 kroner of the 200,000 that someone have decided to be the amount sufficient to get the troll pick raised again. They are going to restore it.
How do you even do that though?
To its previous pride.
Are you going to like glue it on? Like so the vandalism that happened was that someone came and drilled several holes to the point where the thing fractured under its own weight, I guess. But like, are they going to glue it back on? What?
I guess it will get reconstructive surgery
or
something.
So. Troll dick Viagra required. Yeah. It's lovely that people have given money to this. Like, the thing is, it was going to be like an important attraction for the area, right? It's near Stavanger, is that right? I think
so. I don't know.
Well, maybe not, actually. I'm looking at the map.
Yeah.
And the...
Egersund. Yeah, it's kind of south.
But, like... Oh, I feel bad. Like, potentially jobs are destroyed because of this. I feel a little bit bad about that.
Yes, my summer job is to guard the troll stick.
Yeah, Norwegian summer job. What other Norwegian summer jobs would exist that maybe don't exist in the UK?
We are actually placing sort of, not guards, but we have the... the prekestolen.
Yeah.
The pulpit rock and the troll stick on New 7.
Yeah.
All right. So, we are actually placing some people who will take care of all the tourists who destroy themselves on the hiking to the pulpit rock.
Yeah. Looking after, like, bumbling idiot foreigners, basically. That seems like a worthwhile summer job. Yeah. Okay. Good luck, Troll Dick. We wish you well.
We will link to the page where you can contribute to the funding of the resurrection of the Troll Dick.
I'm looking at the amount of money and thinking we can get it up a bit more. I'll get my coat.
Should we just do the picks of the week?
Yeah, we should do that.
Whilst your cultural pick of the week is empty, apparently.
I'm returning null.
Another week without the pick.
This is rich coming from you. Take your moral high ground and shove it.
I have chosen Community, the TV show. Have you seen it?
I think I saw one episode. I think I concluded it's not for me. But tell me why I should care.
Because it's intelligent writing and good actors. And there are quite a lot of puns and jives on the academy or the college academy. So I think you perhaps now with some distance could appreciate it. Perhaps. I don't know.
I can't watch The Office then because again, I've had that job.
It isn't like The Office. It's more constructed It isn't this mockumentary.
Yeah,
at all.
Sorry, that's not really what I meant. I guess like I can't watch The Office because that's a bit too real. I didn't have that problem watching that episode of Community. You know, I didn't go like, oh, I can't watch this because it's just a bit too close to the bone. Like, I've lived this.
It's more a pastiche show. So,
what do you like about it?
What I just said.
The writing and the
and the characters. But also the character of the Dean.
Played by...
Some guy. I will post a link to a YouTube clip sort of summarizing the Dean.
Okay.
And I hope you will appreciate it.
I hope so.
But, right. Word of the week.
I was listening to a podcast, and it's a fairly kind of highbrow podcast, and one of the co-hosts described something as being den hotteste shitten, the hottest shit, like unbelievably cool right now or whatever. And I thought it was funny because it was kind of this Norwenglish kind of construction, but it made me think more generally about how many English language words are kind of repurposed and made into Norwegian, sort of, you know, they're reshaped to fit into the Norwegian language. And I find it kind of charming and amusing. I suspect there's people writing to the newspapers somewhere complaining that the Norwegian language is being degraded by this relentless onslaught of English and American English. I don't know, I was amused by it. And I wondered if you had any more examples.
About...
merged, Norwenglish,
It is always difficult to come with those on the spot. But this week's angry language commentary thing in the newspaper was on the populist construction... I forhold til.
Well, this just never goes away.
No.
I mean, I've been reading about it recently as well, but, like, this never stops. So...
And I don't think we have time to go into the whole thing now, but we have to return to it. It is a weird... It's this omni-expression. You can almost use it everywhere, but you can't really. So, yeah. The hottest shit... The troll stick was the hottest shit this week.
Trollpicken var den hotteste shitten denne uka.
Yeah. Okay, I guess my homework is to recognize and identify appropriation of English terms in the Norwegian language.
Yeah, if you could just neatly catalog them all and like come with a bound volume next week, that would be cool.
Will do.
And I expect you to fit that in around your, like, normal activities. Just make it work for you. It doesn't matter. It just has to be done.
Do I have to get it peer-reviewed?
Yes, it has to be done by then as well.
Yeah.
Who are we kidding? It has to be done, like, in 9 months. Anyway.
I will commit to it now and not deliver.
Excellent. Have a promotion.
Yeah. So, my... word of the week is fremragende, as in context of the academy. So fremragende forskning, for example.
I want it to be bleeding edge.
No.
Frem is forward. Ragende, I'm not sure about.
Yeah. I guess the troll stick is ragende.
Is it like surging ahead?
It's more like extending or like prevalent or something.
So can you use fremragende in a sentence?
Vi har fått et nytt senter for fremragende forskning.
Is not all research by definition fremragende? You can't have research that goes backwards.
We have gotten a new center for excellent research. Or a research center of excellence.
I was going to say, is it a center of excellence? Okay.
Yeah. And there's so much talk about this. Everything has to be fremragen in the university these days. So we strive for getting the status as excellent or something. And they also began to talk about fremragende undervisning and or center for fremragende undervisning, that is
teaching excellence
center. Yeah, so there's an example of the recognition of teaching that has begun to emerge.
I will be interested to see if it's considered possible to do both simultaneously, or whether you have to basically sign up to the one or the other.
But this kind of focus on the concept of excellence and fremragende, it comes with a backside or a question. Where is the appreciation of the mediocre?
I was just going to say, like, I think what we should do is we should celebrate mediocrity. Well, yeah, I got nothing. Define mediocre research. Or does everything now have to be... Does everyone now have to have prizes? Is that where we are?
It is the symptom of the extended feedback loop, I guess. We try to mend it with prizes.
Oh, prizes. Sorry.
Prizes. Really? Didn't you understand it from the context?
Yeah, but my head went around twice with it. Because prices, because, like, you could pay people more. I don't know. I'm easily confused.
Yeah.
Retrospective pick of the week was me talking about gender equality and the boys in skirts. I meant to say.
And where can people find all the tips and picks and links and
troll dick
funding so on?
If you go to smalldifferences.fireside.fm, you will find more troll dick links than you are probably comfortable with, and links to all the other things that we've talked about in today's show and previous episodes, including the thing about doors.
1.5 hour.
I'm so sorry.
No, we aren't.
I'm a little bit sorry. I feel like my rant this could podcast, be more concentrated.
This podcast is like the academy. You are trapped within it, the constraints and demands and all. And you will feel guilty if you leave us. And we will probably, not if not hate, at least despise you for it.
Wait, what?
So just...
I thought there was a point to be made in there somewhere about the fact that, like, there's more to say or more to do, so you just have to find more time in, like, the available time. Something Doctor Who, something TARDIS, I don't know.
Yeah. At this point, you as a listener actually have to listen back to all the episode again backwards and give us feedback that we will not read.
Fair. We always read the feedback. We like the feedback. Thank you, feedback people. We appreciate it. And thank you to Mark Gould, who sent very nice feedback this week.
Yeah. Thanks, Mark.
I guess that's it. Next week, we've got to find a real topic. What are we going to talk about next week?
Should we do this swearing episode? Even though we have promised to do it live.
Unless something better comes along.
Okay. Ha det bra. Takk for at du hørte på.
Ha det bra.